good ectoplasmic body for me, stored the pattern for it in the ring, and linked it to me. Everything you need to drop a fake double of yourself in place as a decoy and simultaneously make yourself unseen. Then I kind of possessed the construct, projected my awareness into it, sent all that energy into it all the way from here, which is exhausting as hell. Had a wonderful chat with McCoy. Murphy helped me sit up, staring at my face intently. "What happened?" she asked. I looked at her and said in a lifeless voice, "I won." "Oh my God," she said. "Is he pissed?" I said with drawn-out, heavy emphasis. She frowned and touched my temple with one hand for a moment. "He hurt you." I closed my eyes. "You should see the other guy." "You two are just precious," the Valkyrie quipped. "Freydis," Murphy said, not unkindly, "fuck off." Freydis looked back and forth between us, frowned, and said, "Fucking off, ma'am." And she left us as much privacy as she could on the little ship as the water beetle chugged forward. "Harry," Murph said gently. I kept my eyes closed. They were overflowing anyway. He's not... Not quite the hero you thought he was? I pressed my lips together. "Yeah," she said. She leaned down and lifted my head into her lap. "He's human. What a shock." "I told him," I said, "about Thomas." "Seems like he reacted a little," she said.
"He killed me,"
I said quietly. "The fake me, I mean. If the fake me had been me, I would now be dead me. He didn't mean to do it, but it happened. And he's not who I thought he was. He was out of control." My voice kind of choked on that last sentence. My chest felt like it should have had knives sticking out of it. I leaned my shoulders back against the bulkhead of the wheelhouse and clamped my left hand over my eyes while I sat on the deck. He was out of control. "Oh, God, Harry," Murphy said, her voice full of pain.
"It hurts," I said quietly.
"Oh, God, it hurts." She put her hand on my forehead, stroking. I lowered my hand and leaned down toward her. And I cried. That went on until it was quiet. Then she said, "I heard the beginning of the conversation, and you're both wrong about each other, you know. You don't really know who he is, not yet, and he doesn't know you. And you both hurt each other terribly because you're family, because what you say and do matters so much more than anyone else." She leaned down and put her cheek against my forehead. "Listen to me. I know it hurts right now, but the reason it hurts so much is because you care about each other so much, and that pain will eventually fade, but you'll both still care." She was right. I did hurt. The kind of pain a magical mantle can't do jack about. The real pain of the heart. The kind that can kill you in about a million ways. Damn the stubborn old fool. "I know this is hard, Harry. I remember when I first realized my dad was just human," she said, "when he shot himself." She let that hang in the air for a while. Then she straightened, framed my face with her hands, and stared out over the darkened lake, her eyes filled with tears. "You can still talk to him, Harry. Something I never got to do. I want you to promise me, for my sake, that you'll talk to him when tempers have cooled." "Karen," I said. She gave one of my cheeks a little slap, annoyed. "Did that sound like a request? Do it. If my advice means a goddamn thing, do it right now. That's how important this is."
What if, I swallowed, what if that's me one day? What if that's what I'm like?
There's a difference between you and him, Murph said.
Yeah?
She moved a bit, leaned down, and kissed my forehead.
Yeah, you've got me.
And something little and warm kindled in my heart. It didn't stop the pain. Oh, God, it did not stop the pain. But it told me the pain wouldn't be there forever.
Fine, I said. I'll talk to him. I made a weary X over my heart.
She patted my cheek approvingly and said,
good man.
I reached for her hand, closed my eyes, and spent a few minutes with tears less bitter.
Chapter 33. I pulled myself together after a bit. There was a cabinet in the wheelhouse where I kept a bunch of long-term storage snacks. Nuts and beef jerky, mostly, plus bottled water. Nothing fancy, but projecting your consciousness was an exhausting activity, and my body needed the calories so badly that the stale nuts and dried jerky tasted freaking delicious. I chomped and guzzled. It took most of an hour to get to the island on a normal trip, but I opened the throttle all the way, so we would get there in slightly less than most of an hour. Murphy limped into the boathouse and kept me company in steady silence, watching my face. After about 10 minutes of that, she said,
you're scared.
I shot her a glance, shrugged a shoulder.
That bad? I thought about it for a moment, while trying not to think about how sick I felt, how worried. Then I said, I can do things, you know? I can burn down buildings if I want to. I can blow up cars, call up things from the never-never. She nodded. Right now, right under my feet, my brother is dying. And maybe the people who want to kill him are already on the way and we won't even get him to the island. And what's about to start happening back in town? I didn't quite manage to suppress a shudder. I feel very small.
Murphy looked at me evenly for a moment. Then her face twisted and she choked down chortling laughter.
You. She shook her head and slammed her shoulder gently against me, still laughing.
What? I asked.
Welcome to the club, she said. Tiny.
I mean it, I said. This is bad stuff.
Right now, she said. Every precinct in Chicago is scrambling to round up every officer it can get. They'll be doing everything they can to get ahead of the chaos that's going to come from the blackout. Firefighters, too, for all the good it will do them. She shook her head. They don't feel too big either. And they don't even have a magic island. I thought about footprints on the beach. Maybe they're about to feel a whole lot smaller, I said. Maybe we all are.
Karen frowned at that. She folded her coat closed around her a little more tightly and leaned against me. I put my arm around her.
Just how bad are we talking here? She asked me. The Fomor think they can wipe out the city, whether we know they're coming or not, I said. They seem sincere.
Wipe out, Murphy said. Old school. Think Attila, Genghis Khan.
Jesus Christ, she breathed and leaned against me. The radio's out, so is the internet in town. How do we warn them?
If only we put out the word to be on guard already, I said wryly. The Paranetters are used to surviving the big kids slugging it out. They'll get together at their safe houses, Max, places like that.
And everyone else? Murphy asked.
Hey, everybody, I said. Mythological monsters are coming to kill you. Please evacuate.
She pressed her lips together in frustration, but acknowledged the point.
So what do we do?
I shook my head.
I don't know.
What's going to happen?
I stared out at the darkness ahead of us, tracking the location of the island
as surely as I would the progress of an ant across my arm, and pushed emotion away from things, thought through the matter as I would any mathematical problem. What makes this different, I said, is Ethneu, and this weapon she has, the Eye of Balor. Yeah, Murphy said. What's up with that thing? I blew out a breath. Hell of a lot of variants in Celtic traditional folklore. It's hard to say. Balor was kind of an equivalent to a Greek titan up in Celt territory. He had this eye that could be used to wither the world, to destroy everything it saw, to set it on fire. He kept it covered behind a bunch of eye patches and veils, and he could remove a few of them at a time to get different kinds of destructive effects, from making things rot to setting them on fire to blasting them to dust. Kind of like gradually reducing the shielding around a radioactive core, Murphy noted. I blinked. Ugh, that's unpleasant to consider, but yes. I don't know how accurate the folklore is, and I haven't talked to anyone with direct knowledge yet, but it's safe to assume that the eye is a weapon of mass destruction, I said. There's a city killer coming to our town. How will they do it? She asked. Come in from the lake, I said. After that, it's old school. Kill everyone they see, she said. And use the eye to blow away any points of hard resistance, I said, nodding. They'll kill or take anyone they can while the mortal authorities flounder in the blackout. Do their worst with the eye, and I have no idea how bad that could be. Then they'll be gone before the National Guard can get there. The people, Murphy said quietly, tonight. There's no one to protect them. The hell there isn't, I said, and coaxed a little more speed out of the old engine. I'll be back before they get here. You, huh? Murphy said, and I could hear the smile in her voice. Against a proto-god with a pocket nuke and an army of monsters. Not just me, I said. But if it had to be just me, yeah, I'd be good with that. It's home. You gotta die somehow. Standing up to a monster at the door isn't a bad way to do it. She was quiet for a moment before she said, I feel you. I squeezed her against me a little harder. Here I am, getting all dramatic. How are you holding up? She shrugged one shoulder. Her voice was heavy and tired. Everything hurts, but I can move some. Maybe you should take shelter, I said. The Paranetters are going to head for Mac's place. They'll need someone to keep a cool head and a sharp watch. She snorted. You think I can't handle myself? Don't, I said quietly. I was ready to take you with me into literal hell, and you know it. Every warrior gets hurt, has limits. There's no shame in acknowledging that. She was quiet for a moment. Then she asked, If you were hurt, would you sit this one out? I said nothing. It's my home too, Harry. I clenched my teeth. And, she said, leaning her cheek against my biceps, if you try to strand me on that damned island to keep me safe, I swear to God I will shoot you in the leg. I stiffened and gave her a quick, guilty glance. She smiled wanly in the green chemical light, widened her eyes, and said in a dramatic impersonation of my voice, I'll be back in time, she snorted. Get over yourself. You are who you are. And mostly I like it. But let's treat each other like grown-ups, promise me. I felt sick. Karen was smart, tough, and capable. She was also hurt. She was also right. And what was coming would give her no special consideration whatsoever. But she was who she was. Karen Murphy could no more have sat quietly by while Chicago burned than she could grow wings and fly. She would fight for her home. She would die for it. Some part of me made whimpering animal sounds way down deep inside. At the end of the day, people have to be who they are. If you try to take that from them,
You diminish them. You reduce them to children, unable to make decisions for themselves. There's no way to poison your relationship with someone else faster. I didn't want to lose her. If she fought, she might well be taken from me. If I tried to keep her from fighting, I would lose her for sure. So, while my heart and some enormous portion of my soul quailed in terror, my mouth said, "I promise." I felt her arm go around my lower back and she squeezed gently for a moment. "Thank you." "Promise me you'll fight smart," I said. She bumped her head against my arm and said, "How would you know if I did?" I huffed out part of a laugh, and we stood together. Chapter 34. The little cheap plastic compass swung and bobbled as the boat did, but I didn't need it. Now that I had acquainted myself with the island's arcane functions, I had my own personal compass, a subtle, tiny sensation in my head that always told me where I could find the place. That was part and parcel of being the warden of Demon Reach. I felt it when the water beetle hit the outer ring of defenses about a mile out from the island. With a few words and an effort of will, I could have had the island causing treacherous currents, frigid vortexes that would pull intruders down to sharp rocks below. The lake would have boiled like a sea under a storm. I could tell that Karen felt the island's influence as well, a subtle presence that caused unease in all who entered. It prevented casual visitors. No one who came into these waters would feel at ease until they'd changed course to go around the island. Hell, planes didn't fly directly overhead. That's how powerful the island's influence was. That wasn't a planned defense, exactly. It was simply the natural presence of the things held prisoner there, a menagerie of supernatural terrors that started with some of the foulest beings I'd ever faced and progressed down into the depths of nightmare from there. Demon Reach was the Alcatraz of the supernatural world, and I was the guy holding all the keys. I could have found that place blindfolded and in the dark. Hell, I was finding it in the dark, piloting the ship without much need to turn the wheel until the looming mass of the island rose above us. We'd prepared for arriving at night. The floating dock my brother and I had built, the What's Up dock, had been lined with luminescent marine tape. I cut the throttle and came in slow and careful. Even without the possibility of aquatic bad guys, operating a boat was a damn dangerous occupation for fools, so I had to be extra cautious. I saw Freydis move up to the prow of the ship as we approached the dock, skin glowing in the green chemical light. She rubbed her arms a few times as the shadow of the island fell over her, as if the place chilled her. Beside me, Karen shifted restlessly. "It's that bad?" I asked her. "You don't feel it at all, do you?" she asked. "It's... you know that feeling, when you're dreaming and you realize you're in a nightmare?" She nodded toward the island. "It's that, in IMAX." "Yeah," I said. "Well, it's not supposed to be a place where visitors are welcome." "I worry about you when you're out here," she said. "What it's doing to you." "It's not doing anything to me," I said. "I'm the warden." "Maybe," she said. "Or maybe it's something you can't feel happening to you, something else." A disturbing thought, but not one I hadn't had before. "You're just going to have to trust me." "Yeah, that's why I'm standing here." I brought the ship in carefully to the dock, and Freydis leapt like a doe down from the ship and started making her fast. "Is the cabin still livable?" Karen asked. "It has supplies?" "Everything we need," I said. I cut the motor and headed out of the wheelhouse. "I'll check on Thomas." I cracked a fresh light and took it down below decks with me, to the boat's little living compartment, and into a tableau from some kind of Renaissance painting.
The boat had a couple of bunks, nothing fancy, generally covered in white sheets and heavy red plaid blankets. Thomas and Lara were reclining on one of them. She sat up at the head of the bunk, and he was sprawled back, his shoulders across her upper body. Both were naked, and there was nothing sexual in the moment at all. One of her hands held his broken ones upon his chest. The other simply cupped his cheek. Her head was bowed, as if in exhaustion, and her shoulders sagged. Her hair spilled across her face, hiding all but a bit of her profile, and brushed across his forehead. My brother's eyes were open, unfocused. They had acquired faint hints of gray among the silver in his gaze. He looked like some poor, broken knight being gathered into the gentle arms of an angel of death. "What the hell?" I asked. Lara lifted her gaze to me, her eyes flickering with bits of mirror-bright silver that shifted even as I took note of them, sending the eerie light of the chemical stick dancing about them in fluttering kaleidoscope changes of all shades of otherworldly green. I tore my eyes away before something bad happened. "Lara, what are you doing?" It took her a moment to speak. Her voice came out furry and delicious. "I'm giving him the energy I took earlier. It's slowing down the damage his hunger is inflicting. But it's very bad. And I'm almost..." She licked her lips. The sight of it made me want to rip off my shirt and start boasting of my many manly deeds. "Empty." She made the word sound like a sin. "I'll need to feed if I'm going to give him more." "Not really an option," I said. I had to clear my throat in the middle. "We're here." She looked up at me, her silver eyes sharp and clear. "And you're sure you can protect him here? Even from his own hunger?" "Everything we need," I said. "Give him to me." She nodded and said, "Take him." She transferred Thomas to me, wrapped in a blanket. The air around her was cold, like gorgeously cold. Like I wanted to take my shirt off and stretch out in it and cool off. And the winter mantle let out a low growl in my mind that suggested that a number of terrible ideas were in fact the most interesting concepts I'd ever considered. "Damn it, Lara," I snapped in irritation. "We're working." She blinked at me for a moment at that, as I wrapped a blanket around him and gathered Thomas up like a child. "Involuntary, honestly. We can always choose to use the hunger. We can't always choose not to." "Well, it's annoying," I said grumpily. She lifted her hand and quickly covered a smile. "Oh, you know, I've never been told that before. Not once." I rolled my eyes and said, "I believe you. It would be a trick to carry my brother up the narrow stairwell to the deck, but whatever." I growled in irritation and toted him out. He was still barely conscious, and he felt entirely too light. Stupid Svart elves. Stupid vampires. Stupid titans. Stupid Thomas. Why in the hell had my brother gotten himself into this mess? I got him up on the deck, and Freydis was there to steady me. The red-headed Valkyrie eyed me in the light and nodded toward the island. "Not much here." "Everything we need," I said. "Don't step off the dock. I'm not sure what would happen to you." Freydis looked at me and shuddered. "I won't." I brushed past her and carried my brother down the dock toward the island itself. No one stopped me. Everyone was too worried about what was happening back in Chicago, which was just as well. I had told everyone Thomas would be safe on the island. I hadn't yet told them where he'd be staying. See, the thing about keeping people safe is that, in the end, if you really want to keep someone truly protected, your only option is to lock them up. Fortresses are prisons. And vice versa. I started up the dock and stepped into the rough ground of the island, walking with perfectly sure footing, my intellectus of the place making it impossible to slip or fall. I knew Demon Reach, every tree and stone, as thoroughly as I knew my own body. I had taken fewer than a dozen steps onto the stones of the island before there was a massive movement in the trees. I came to a halt, waiting, as the figure came gliding out of the darkness. It was enormous, as tall as a titan, and far broader, a menacing shape in a billowing, shadowy cloak and hood that hid its form from the human eye. A pair of green flames burned somewhere back in the hood, supernaturally bright eyes that were currently narrowed in something like concern. The vast figure drifted out to a halt in front of me and bowed slowly, formally, from the waist.
"Warden," it said. Its voice was a grating rumble of stone and tearing earth, heard as much inside my head and chest as with my ears. "You have returned."
"Alfred," I said, "we've got trouble right here in River City." The genius Loki of the island regarded me in stillness for a moment before it said,
"The island is in a lake."
The supernatural crowd is not generally up on any cultural reference that has occurred since the Renaissance. Human reference, Alfred, pay it no mind.
"As you command, Warden." The enormous hood tilted to one side, verdant gaze fixing on my brother's unmoving form. "Your bloodkin is dying."
"I know," I said. "We're going to help him."
"I am not made to help," Alfred said.
There wasn't any passion to the statement. There was no mercy either. Alfred was the spirit of the prison itself, a place constructed to contain magical threats too dangerous to be permitted to roam the world. Over the millennia, more than 6,000 beings of terrible power had been consigned to the oubliette tunnels beneath the island. They were a legion of nightmares, the least of which made me shudder in a very real fear I could never quite shake. Alfred was the being created to maintain their isolation. He wasn't what you call easygoing. "Right," I said. "We're going to place him in stasis." Alfred's eyes blazed several shades brighter with eagerness.
"It has been over long since the last foulness was consigned to my everlasting care," it said. "This parasite-riddled vermin scarcely qualifies for minimum security."
"I want him held," I said. "I want his hunger held helpless as well, until such time as I return to release him."
"Which penitence protocol shall he suffer, Warden?"
There were several that could be inflicted on the inmates of the prison. Some were bound in darkness, some in torment, some in simple confinement. The various wardens of Demon Reach had tinkered with the cells for a very, very long time. Some of the protocols had been developed before civilization had been more than a few collections of huts and fires in the darkness. They were not kind. There was one prisoner held below in a kind of unique stasis, something that could most closely be considered sleep, though he could also awaken and perform limited communications for short periods of time. It was, as best as I could understand, the only protocol with sanity-saving sleep built into it. The prison had never been meant for something as frail and nearly mortal as my brother. Thomas made a soft, ugly little sound, as if only his utter exhaustion was holding him back from screaming in pain. "Contemplation," I responded quietly. "He is to be shielded from any communication with other prisoners not enduring the same protocol. Give me the crystal." The Great Spirit bowed again. When it straightened, a shard of crystal, about the length of a socket wrench, like quartz but pulsing with the quiet green light, lay shimmering upon the earth. I lowered my brother to the ground. He groaned as I settled him down. The gray in his eyes had faded again, as his hunger apparently renewed its assault on his life force. He had slowly begun to show signs of helpless agony, as whatever palliative energy Lara had given him began to fade.
"Hey, man," I said, "can you hear me?"
He might have focused his eyes on me for a second. Only sounds of pain came out of his mouth.
"Look," I said quietly.
I drew a pocket knife I'd stuffed in my suit pants before leaving and used the needlepoint to pink the pad of flesh between thumb and forefinger. After a second, droplets of blood welled up, and I smeared the blade of the pocket knife over them, staining its length with a shade of scarlet just a little too pale to be human.
"I can keep your demon from hurting you, keep you alive, but going in will be rough."
One of his ruined hands landed on my arm. He squeezed weakly. It was barely there, but it was there. He'd heard me.
"Part of the process of being taken into the cells is," I took a deep breath, "you suffer the pain you've inflicted on others," I said. "It was meant to get through to the most alien of beings why they were being imprisoned. It's not fair. It's not meant for people. It could hurt you. But if I don't do it, you're going to die."
My brother forced his eyes open and tried to find me.
Justine, I said, "I know, I'm on it."
He sobbed. That was all he had left in him. I stood away, leaving him within the light of the crystal. Alfred loomed over Thomas.
"You have the cage, you have the blood. Draw the circle and speak the words, Warden."
My instincts twitched. I looked back over my shoulder. Freitas stood at the very edge of the dock, staring up the slope at me.
Even as I watched, she turned and rushed back to the ship, leaping up onto the deck and vanishing into the hold.
There wasn't much time. My brother was fading, being devoured by his own demon.
I rose and drew in my will while I used my staff to gouge a circle into the earth around my brother. Once that was done, I bent over, touched the little trench with my fingers, and raised the circle by unleashing a tiny amount of energy into it. It snapped up into an invisible screen around my fallen brother and began to gather and focus magical energy. Then I raised the pocket knife overhead in one hand.
"Bound be Thomas Wraith," I hissed.
I felt resistance against my will begin to rise, the reluctance of this world to open a passage to another.
"Bound be my wounded brother," I growled, forcing my will into my voice, making it ring from the stones and trees and water. "Fallen warrior, father-to-be, I name him Bound, consigned to thee."
I heard a brief cry from behind me. I released my will with the third repetition of the binding, and Demon Reach went to work. I didn't have the kind of power it would have taken to do what the genius Loki did. The energy I'd had to pour into the incantation had simply been to release a portion of the spirit's power, like turning the key in an enormous, stiff, stubborn lock. Demon Reach was not meant to be used by the weak-minded or the uncertain. And the effort it had taken to set it into motion was not one I would care to repeat on a regular basis for exercise. The crystal flared with light. It bathed Thomas so brightly that I could see his bones through his skin. And then my poor, battered brother began to scream. It was a thin, shrieking sound, a sound that embraced more emotion, more agony than his broken body could possibly bear. It ripped at me, that sound, causing me pain that the winter mantle could do absolutely nothing about. I had just condemned my brother to a punishment that I would have been terrified to face myself. Thomas screamed and screamed, and the vast form of the genius Loki towered over him, bending down, and then the screams ended. The light vanished, and I stood alone on the cold stones. Where my wounded brother had been, there was nothing but a very faintly glowing cloud of green mist, dispersing rapidly, sinking into the stone and earth of Demon Reach. I sagged, dropped down to one knee, bracing my arms on the ground. Stars and stones. What I had just done, there had been no choice, especially not now. But my brother. I heard a single low cry, raw and ugly with pain. I turned to see Lara land on the dock and rush toward me, a pale blur of supernatural speed, something that gleamed and caught the moonlight in her hand. Chapter 35. Lara Wraith didn't like to fight. It was what made her such a deadly opponent when she had to do it. Once the knives were out, she didn't let pride come into it at all. If she decided to kill you, it was going to happen as quickly and efficiently as she could arrange, and that would be that. I had personally seen her walk through a battlefield full of ancient foes armed with nothing but a pair of long knives. She hadn't just beaten them, she'd made it look easy. She was older than my brother, and she'd taught him to fight. Thomas had walked into a Svartov fortress and damn near assassinated its chief executive through all the security, all by himself. Lara was faster than my brother, stronger than him, and more experienced. And now she was coming for me. I got it. I mean, this was the only place on the planet I was sure Thomas would be safe. But if she'd known the details, she'd have fought me on it, and there just hadn't been time. For all she knew, I just disintegrated her brother. If I'd been in Lara's shoes, I'd have been freaking out too. She probably didn't realize she'd chosen her ground even more poorly than my brother had. Demon Reach had been constructed by Merlin, the Merlin, the original Camelot and Excalibur, that Merlin. He'd broken at least one of the laws of magic to build the place, romping about through time in order to lay a foundation strong enough to bear the supernatural weight of the prison. As a result, the island absolutely seethed with power. And if one knew the layout of the defenses and the painstaking geomancy that had gone into laying out all that energy into usable patterns, it was possible to use that energy at almost no cost to one's own store of personal power. Behind Lara, Freydis and her shotgun vaulted off the ship and onto the shore, the Valkyrie following her boss into battle. Except it wasn't a battle. It wasn't even close. I made a gesture, hissed part of a word, and the soft ground beneath Lara's feet abruptly gave way and then snapped back, sending her into a sprawl in the air. She hit the ground, and the brush and grass of the island wrapped her swiftly and completely. I made a swatting gesture with my right hand, sent out a mental command to utilize some of the waiting energy of the island, and a hickory tree that towered above the landing site abruptly swept down like an angry giant and slammed an enormous branch into the ground a few feet in front of Freydis. The impact knocked the Valkyrie from her feet, and at a second gesture, the tree hit her hard enough to send her flying back into the water of the lake. I turned back to find Lara tearing her way wildly out of the grass and brush, and I had to lift both hands and expend a mild effort of will to have the ground simply swallow her to the neck. Lara struggled briefly, savagely, and silently, her silver eyes bright. It took her about half as long as it would have taken me to realize the hopelessness of her position. The struggle ceased then, and she went cold and so still that her head might have been something severed from a statue rather than part of an actual near human being. Only her eyes moved, tracking me. There was nothing playful in her expression now. It was like looking at the eyes of a big cat, an angry one. "That wasn't necessary," I said, turning to track Freydis's progress in the water. My intellectus was a little fuzzier out there, like peering through smudged glass, which was probably the penalty for my merely human brain struggling to be aware of the constant shifting of every individual molecule of water in the area. I found Freydis just as she kicked off the bottom of the lake, churning the water into swirling helixes with the power of her limbs as she stroked for the surface, and flew out of it with enough momentum to clear the railing of the water beetle and collide with Murphy on the deck. "No!" I shouted, and with an effort of will and another flick of my wrists, a pair of trees bent and reached for the ship, wood straining, limbs creaking with threat. Freydis was fast as hell, and Murphy didn't even try to fight her. The Valkyrie got behind Murphy, close, one hand on her waist and another on her throat. I knew how strong she was. She could just rake a pound of meat out of Murphy's neck with a flick of her wrist. Freydis's eyes were bright and cold. "Back off!" she screamed. The power of Demon Reach was vast and terrible, and not much good for surgery. The only chance I'd have would be something that killed Freydis so fast that she didn't have time to react, and the Valkyrie was damned quick. I'd be aiming trees, for God's sake I should have practiced smashing things with trees, at targets on a floating, bobbing platform, and an inch's difference in any direction could mean Murphy's life or death. So I backed off, the trees groaning threateningly as they retreated. "Trade time, Sidomata," Freydis called to me. "Yours for mine." "Why should I?" I called back. Freydis tightened her hand, and I saw Murphy tense up with pain. "This is not the fight that is destined to be her last," the Valkyrie called, "unless you make me kill her." Murphy simply lifted her arms. There were a couple of clinking sounds, and a pair of metal bits flew up from her hands and arched out to either side of the water beetle, landing in the water with little splashes. They were little metal handles. Soldiers call them spoons. Murphy was holding a live grenade to either side of their heads. Freydis's eyes went very wide. "Frags," Murphy said calmly. "Your move, bitch." There was an instant of frozen silence. "Gods, that's hot," Freydis said and blurred as she dove over the railing, hitting the water like a thrown spear. Murphy turned and pitched the grenades over the far side of the water beetle. She had to lob one of them underhand with her wounded arm. They hit the drink maybe 7 or 8 yards out, and a couple of seconds later they went off with a roar of displaced liquid that sent a geyser of water 20 feet in the air. I ignored that. The frags were no danger to anything when they were surrounded by that much water. And instead, I tracked the evasive Valkyrie until I found her. I raised my voice and called out to where Freydis had tried to swim silently back to shore, in the shadows and shelter of some huge old shaggy willows. She came out of the water and picked up a rock, and was about to start through the trees and rocks on a least time course for the back of my skull. "Hey, Red," I called. "Your client is fine. There's no reason to fight me, and if you make me spend what's left of my money on Wehrguild for your boss, I'm going to be really annoyed." Freydis paused in the darkness in confusion. I didn't blame her. There was no way I could have seen her from where I was standing, no way I could have heard her stealthy movements. But while I stood on Demon Reach, I was as aware of the island as of my own body. I could have chucked a rock, bounced it off a couple of trees, and landed it right on the Valkyrie's head. Sometimes actions speak louder than words. I lifted a hand and willed the earth of the island to cooperate. Freydis found herself sunk to her waist in the ground in the space of a heartbeat. I heard her let out a short, choked sound. "See," I called to her, "this is just a terrible idea, just awful. For you, I mean. Maybe we can talk instead." Freydis' voice came out a little breathless. "Lara?" I looked at Lara and made an impatient gesture with one hand. "Come on." "I'm alive," Lara called back to her. Then she looked at me and said evenly, "You traitor." "Hey," I said, lifting an annoyed finger, "I'm not the one who came running at you with a knife." "What did you do to him?" Lara asked, her voice cold and measured. I'd heard the tone before, back when I'd had to put the fear of well, me, into a vampire named Bianca. We'd sort of been amicable opponents up until that point. Things changed when I made her feel helpless. Things had gotten a little complicated. And I just repeated history. Only Lara was smarter and stronger and a great deal more dangerous than Bianca had ever thought about being. This was one of those situations where maybe it would be wise to use my words. I walked over to Lara and settled down on my haunches next to her. "I did exactly what I said I would do," I said. "He's safe. Locator spells won't be able to lock on to him here. His demon can't hurt him. The Svartalfs can't get to him. We did it."
"I want to see him," Lara hissed. "I want to talk to him."
I rubbed at my eyes. "You can't," I said. I frowned and reached for my intellectus of the island. I felt what my brother felt, which was not much. There was distant pain, but mostly he had simply sunk into an exhausted stupor. His mind had been overwhelmed by physical stimuli. Now he sought blessed shelter in oblivion. "He's unconscious." She stared at the middle distance, refusing to look up at me.
"Unconscious?"
"He's locked in one of the cells," I said. "He's safe, but he's stuck, too. And right now he's exhausted, resting."
"You never said anything about locking him in a cell."
"I said he'd have to stay here." Lara let out a small, bitter laugh.
"You did, and you kept your word. To think I believed you'd come into Mab's service as a result of misfortune rather than aptitude."
I winced at that one.
"Ow."
"You've made your point, I believe, Dresden," Lara said somewhat stiffly. "The current balance of power does not favor me. Is it really necessary to keep me in this position?"
"Are you done with the knife play?" I asked.
"I am ready to negotiate rationally," she said. I gave her a professionally suspicious look. Her poker face was much better than mine.
"Fine," I said. I stepped back and gestured.
The ground just sort of slid away from her, bringing her back to her feet without any effort needed on her part. As her right hand came free, she lifted a small practical knife that she'd been hiding somewhere. She put it back into the sheath she held in the other hand and then tossed the knife down onto the ground between us.
"Thank you," she said stiffly. "I'd appreciate it if we could deal frankly with one another at this point."
"Sure," I said.
"What do you want?" she asked.
"For what?"
"Don't be coy, Dresden," Lara said. "You hold my brother's life in your hand now. What is your price?"
I lifted my eyebrows.
"Wait, you think that..."
"Wow." She tilted her head.
"Lara, look," I said.
"I'm slowly growing more aware of things, but you're giving me too much of what you probably think is credit. I don't play the game like that."
"A cursory review of your defeated foes begs to differ, wizard."
"I'll play hardball," I acknowledged, "but I play it clean. Or at least I don't sell my own damn brother up the river for gain."
"You're not that much of an idealist, Dresden," Lara said with a faint, hard smile on her mouth.
"At the end of the day, you'll commit genocide if you think it's the proper thing to do."
"You're goddamn right I will," I said, because the empirical evidence was pretty tough to dispute.
"But if I was as hardcore as you think I am, you wouldn't be walking off this island with your own mind. And maybe not at all." Lara narrowed her eyes.
"What do you mean by that?"
I threw up my hands. "Hell's bells, Lara. Look, if I wanted to do something bad to you, I could right now. You're standing in the wrong place. I have the advantage. And if I wanted to wreak some manner of skullduggery upon you, you aren't in a position to stop me from doing it."
Words could not be more rigid than the ones she spoke. "I am aware."
"No," I said. "That's not..."
"Look, I'm not saying that because I'm trying to leverage you. I'm pointing out that I can do it, but I'm not going to because it's just dickish. And I try to avoid acting like that whenever I can.
Lara frowned.
What? Look, I know you play the game real hard, I said. That's in your nature. But you also understand family.
She tilted her head, frowning.
What do you mean by that? That Thomas is my family, too, I said. I won't do anything to knowingly harm him. Again. And if he needs me, I'll be there for him.
And, Lara murmured thoughtfully, I suppose if anything happens to you, terrible things happen to my brother.
Not terrible, I said, just nothing.
Unless the next warden decided to free him. I hadn't yet finished reviewing the inmates of the island. The filing system of the island, such as it was a psychic one. Reviewing the inmates meant reviewing the inmates. The first half dozen or so had left me with nightmares for a couple of weeks, and there's only so much masochism I can keep all to myself.
He's trapped there forever,
Lara said. No, he's safe there until we can find a way to cure him, I said. She regarded me with flat eyes.
And as a happy side effect, if I wish to protect his life now, I must invest resources in protecting yours.
That hadn't been what I'd been planning at all. And yet, by Lara's standards, that's exactly what I'd done. There's plenty of daylight between intentions and results. Intentions are fine things, but they don't staunch bleeding or remove scars. Or heal broken brothers.
Man, I hadn't planned it like that. Had I?
Maybe I'd been hanging around Mab too much. Lara, I said tiredly, I'll grant you, yes, that's how things stand. We can talk all night about how they got there, but I swear to you, I didn't do it to try to get a handle on you. Of every person you have had to deal with, which of them has tried harder to avoid even touching your handles? She stared at me with that unreadable expression for a good minute. Then she said, Empty night, wizard. Either you're sincere, in which case, she shook her head, baffled. I feel I do not understand you very well at all. Or you're a person capable of using even your brother's misfortune and possible death to secure gain for yourself, while simultaneously cladding your actions in such moral armor as to make them practically unassailable. In which case, I suppose, I admire your skill in arranging matters.
I figure you can look at this two ways, I said. She arched an eyebrow. You can write this down in your little black book and remember it, I said, because I took a cheap shot at you when you needed help, when you earned it, and when you came to ask for it, you deserved getting it, and instead I leveraged you.
That is one way to look at it, Lara concurred.
Or, I said, you can take it as a bit of circumstance that happened because circumstances are bug nuts, absolutely insane. And you and I do not have reasonable jobs for sane and rational people. Both of us are making it up as we go along, as best we know how. Both of us look for the knives coming at our backs, and both of us take action to prevent them. That includes being suspicious-minded enough to take out a little insurance, even when you aren't consciously thinking about doing so. Something like grudging understanding tinged her gaze for a second. She let out a soft snort through her nose. So, she said, you agree with the old man and decided to be a very clever frog with this scorpion.
I respect what you can do, Lara, I said quietly.
You're one of my favorite frenemies.
But if we both want to survive, a certain amount of moving past these rough spots is going to be necessary.
She let out a hard little laugh. I suppose, then, I shall expect a similar amount of tolerance from you
when one day I have the upper hand.
I winced at her tone. It was hard, unforgiving. I'm pretty sure I could have thought of a number of terrible things I could do to Lara Wraith that wouldn't have made her blink. But making her feel helpless was not on that list. I definitely did not want to think about Lara gaining the upper hand between us. I didn't want to think about that for more than a couple of reasons.
Yeah, that's fair, I breathed. When it's my turn, I'll have to take it with grace. But look, you got what you wanted. Our brother is safe. He's hidden from any tracking spells, and he'll at least not be in any worse shape while he's a guest here. Yes, you're going to have to watch my back until we get him out of here. But since Mab's got me covering yours anyway, that shouldn't be too much of a stretch for you. And we've got bigger fish to fry right now. Let's survive the night, and we'll sort out Thomas tomorrow. Agreed? She kept at it with those flat eyes for another minute before she shook her head and pushed her dark hair back out of her eyes. Fine, she said. Yes. All right. Your reasoning is sound. We have larger issues to face. They must take priority. I accept your terms. You have my word.
Thank you, I said. Lara recovered her knife and turned away from me.
And after that, she said, starting back for the boat, my first prerogative shall be balancing any scales between us that seem less than level. Beginning with my bodyguard, you will release her, please.
I gestured, muttered to the island, and felt Freydis' tension ease as she escaped the sinkhole I'd put her in. The red-headed Valkyrie melted out of the shadows. She paced over to Lara's side, checking her client for injury, before giving me the kind of steady, cautious look people normally reserve for dangerous animals.
Shall we return to the city, then? Lara asked. Her voice was its normal velvet loveliness again, but I could feel the sharp edges underneath.
Fabulous. This was just what I needed, to provide people like Lara with motivation.
Go ahead and board, I said. I need to grab a couple things. We'll leave in 5 minutes.
Lara nodded stiffly and turned to walk back to the ship. She was limping slightly and had been thoroughly muddied. I watched her go.
Shall I prepare another cell for that one?
I turned to find the island spirit looming over my shoulder, and I hadn't sensed Alfred's approach, which bothered me. I mean, my intellectus of the island was essentially without limit. With a minor effort of concentration, I could have known how many ants were on the island, how many birds, how many fish in the waters off its shores. But I couldn't find out more about the inhabitants of the cells without dragging my brain through their psychic rap sheets, experiencing, to some degree, everything they were and had done. And I couldn't sense Alfred or his movements. I mean, the spirit had come every time I'd called. And I'd been assuming this whole time that it had to. But Alfred was apparently able to hide things from me. The spirit could hide its presence from my intellectus of the island, for example. And it could hide the innate terror of the island's inmates, preventing it from taking a toll on my psyche. So I kind of had to wonder, what else could Demon Reach be hiding from me?
That won't be necessary, I muttered back to the spirit.
Alfred, how big a being can the cells contain?
Physical size is not a factor, the spirit replied. Metaphysical mass is a different consideration.
The creature's green eyes suddenly flashed fiercely.
The last titan is on the move.
Yes, I said simply. Can you hold her?
If you can perform the binding, I can hold her, Alfred said.
From how far out? I asked.
I am a jailer, not a bounty hunter, Alfred replied. Perhaps to the shores of the lake, if you use the athame from the armory.
An athame is a magical tool. Think magic wand, but in the form of a knife. They're powerful tools for ritual magic. I had one locked up in the island's armory. I'd stolen it from the god of the underworld, from the same shelf as the shroud and the crown of thorns. If it truly was what I was pretty sure it was, then using it was going to put me in a long-term pickle. But if the storm coming for Chicago was as bad as I thought it was going to be, not using it would be unthinkable. To the shore, huh? I said. All right, get me the knife, and a binding crystal, and the placard.
You wish two of the weapons?
Alfred sounded slightly intimidated. That's the kind of power level we were talking about. Sure, I said in the most cavalier fashion I could. After all, that's only half the arsenal. And as soon as I leave, I want the full defensive measures of the island activated. Nothing gets in or out. Understood?
Understood, Warden, the entity said with a bow.
Great, I sighed. Now run and get me my toys, Alfred. I've got a long night coming up.
Chapter 36. When I got back to the boat, Karen was up on top of the boathouse, seated on the stool there. Her P90, a personal defense weapon that was the bastard child of an assault rifle and a box of Belgian chocolates, was resting on the safety railing, its barrel aimed in the same general direction as where I'd been standing and negotiating moments before. I checked. She had a good line of sight to where I'd been standing with Lara, as well as to where Freitas had come out of the water. Had them both lined up, huh? I asked. She shrugged. I know who my friends are. But you didn't shoot. She folded her arms as if cold.
I know who my enemies are, too.
She glanced down toward where Lara and Freitas were below decks, washing off mud and changing into some spare clothing. Some of it was Thomas's and would sort of fit.
Lara's tired and scared and running on instinct, Karen continued. She'd have never come at you the way she did here, otherwise.
I regarded Karen for a second. Then I said, surprised, "You like her?"
I find her terrifying, she replied calmly. But I will acknowledge a certain amount of respect. When we worked together in the BFS, she always held up her end and always kept her word. That's not nothing.
No, it isn't, I said. I opened up the boat so that the roar of the engine would prevent Lara from overhearing a conversation. Vampires in their hearing. So I made an enemy of her. Karen snorted. Maybe. But I saw the whole thing. You beat her, but you didn't show her any disrespect. She's not as petty as most of the rest of the supernatural types I've met. Maybe she'll decide to overlook it. She shrugged. And if she wants to fight, we'll fight her. Tonight was high stress and special. I'm pretty sure any fight Lara starts in the future is going to be set up so that we don't get a turn, I said. Karen turned bright blue eyes up at me. So? You want to kill her right here? Drop her in the lake? Course not, I said, annoyed. And stop borrowing trouble, she said.
Either throw down right now or accept
the fact that by not doing so, you're giving her the upper hand. Either way, complaining isn't going to help you.
If the council gives me the boot, I said, there's nothing stopping her from coming at me however she wants.
Karen snorted. Merely mab. I pursed my lips. True that. Honestly, my long-term prognosis was for death by mab, one way or another. But until I fell trying to do something for her, I had a certain advantage in my role as the official thug of Winter. I was high profile. Anyone who wanted to come at me outside the various shadow games would have to run the table of serious risks to make the attempt. And even then, if they didn't pull it off perfectly so that they could vanish the body and avoid my death curse, it would be bound to catch up to them sooner or later,
in the person of the Winter Queen. Nobody particularly cared to cross anyone from Winter, much less the she who ruled over the other predatory fae by dint of sheer wickedness and power. Mab's reputation and force of personality had created the Unseelie Accords from whole cloth. Mab was not a kind or gentle boss, but she'd never betrayed me, either. When she made a promise, she meant it, and everyone knew it. Everyone but Ethnew, apparently. I found myself turning the binding crystal over and over in my hand. It was about 6 inches long and between 1 inch and 2 inches thick, and glowed with a very, very faint luminescence that one could see only indirectly. "That like the one you used on Thomas?" Murphy asked. "Yeah." "You think you can get a Titan inside one of those?" "Sure," I lied. She spat casually over the side of the boat and gave me a look. I grimaced. "Bindings are difficult work. You pit your will against whatever you're trying to bind. If your will is stronger, it gets bound. If not..." "Whatever you tried to bind comes to kill you?" "She was doing that anyway," I pointed out. Karen bobbed her head to one side in a little gesture of acceptance. "So your head is harder than Thomas's?" "He wasn't in much shape to fight," I said. I chewed on my lip thoughtfully. He'd had a long, long day. Karen nodded. "You hurt him, putting him in there, didn't you?" "Maybe more than he's ever been hurt," I said. "Didn't have many options." "Mother of God." She looked up at me and then out at the dark. "I'm sorry that you had to do that to him."
"Didn't hurt me."
"Sure. What happens to Thomas if you don't make it through the fight?"
"He stays there," I said. "Probably for good."
"Harry, I need your honesty here. Can he be healed? Or are you just buying him time?"
I shrugged a shoulder and shook my head. "I don't know."
"You don't?
Hey, I'm making this up as I go along." I thought of my brother, trapped in a crystal prison for the next foreseeable eternity, and Justine and his kid alone. "But I have to try." She exhaled through her teeth and nodded.
"You do."
The boat chugged steadily through the water back toward town. We both stood, staring toward it, silent tension rising. I felt her hand slip into mine. There were lights shining in the city now, though we couldn't see them until we got within sight of shore. Candles in windows, larger fires, maybe in trash cans. The city was silent and dim in the darkness, unnaturally still. Waiting. And somewhere inside it, my daughter would be asleep right now, with Mouse somewhere under her feet. I thought of the hideous scarlet light of the eye tearing through Marcone's little fortress. "This," I breathed, "this is too big."
"What do you mean?" she asked.
"It's too big," I said. "This isn't a war-torn nation where it can be explained away, or an odd duck private investigator with a quirky shtick. It's Chicago. Ethnew and King Korb aren't even trying to keep this quiet. The kind of blood that's going to be spilled, it will cry out.
People will be terrified," Murphy said.
"And they'll set out to destroy what frightens them," I said. "It'll make the Spanish Inquisition look like a bouncy castle." Murphy shuddered.
"If Ethnew and Korb pull this off, they'll set the mortal world and the supernatural world at war." I stared ahead at the dim skyline of my city, ghostly in the darkness.
"Yeah," I growled. "If." And I gave the old boat all it had.
This is James Marsters. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Peace Talks, a novel of the Dresden Files by Jim Butcher. This program was directed by Francis Loy. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2020 by Jim Butcher. Production copyright 2020, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.